Where There's a Will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life, is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.
You're listening to Where There's a Will, a podcast from A Lust for Life about the mental health system in Ireland. In this six-part series, we ask why our mental health system is so dysfunctional, who is responsible for making change happen, and how we can collectively respond, join the dots, and make things better for all of us. I'm Paula McLaughlin.
And I'm Ciara O'Connor. And in this series, we'll be tackling some tough issues and sharing stories about mental health which may be difficult to hear. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. Or if you just need to talk, you can contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP.
Now that we've reached the end of this series, we can reflect on what we've heard so far and try and make some sort of sense of it. We've heard about a system being described as not fit for purpose, not functional. We've heard about log jams and wait lists, lack of access and lack of resources. But having listened to so many perspectives, it seems like these are all just symptoms. Let's cast our minds back to the people we heard. What was really damaging to them was the attitude they faced, how they were treated. Every system is built on an invisible foundation, supported by invisible scaffolding. In this episode of Where There's a Will, we'll try and shine a light on some of the philosophical underpinnings of our system as it stands. Because there's a battleground and some very different worldviews, all clamouring to shape what our mental health systems globally will look like in the future. And as with a lot of things at the moment, there are polarising viewpoints, mostly centred around the medicalisation and pathology of mental health. So we're going to look at some radical thinking and hear some dissenting voices in mental health who are going to speak about the shifting sands of power in mental health, pulling away from the system and towards people who need the support. We'll hear from Professor Peter Kinderman on how he deals with being called a litany of names. Dr. Pat Bracken on how hard it can be to challenge your profession. Dr. Terry Lynch on why we need to stop relying on diagnoses. And we'll hear what happens when we call for a paradigm shift in how we view mental health in Ireland. First of all, we'll hear from Nikki. Nikki was the only person I spoke to who had had a genuinely good experience in getting help for her mental health. She was treated with dignity and respect. She had ready access to care when she needed it. And she was offered multiple different types of support and treated as a partner in her recovery. Why? Because she had health insurance. So here's Nikki, telling us about her experiences of what good care and support can and should look like.
So I definitely started becoming unwell when I was about 14, I'd say. But back then, you didn't really know anyone who was depressed, and certainly not at a teenage. So it was completely ignored and left. I think I always just thought it would eventually go away. And it didn't. It was Christmas 2009. I mean, I was walking around like a zombie, just hoping like a car would knock me over. That was absolute rock bottom. I had to go up to the GP for something else. And I couldn't get out of the bed. I walked up there looking like a scarecrow. Like, it was horrendous. Like, I just couldn't physically look after myself. And he just looked at me and was, oh my God, like, what's wrong, Nikki? And I said, really depressed. And he was like, but I referred you to Johnny Gaz. Did we not put you in as an actual inpatient? And I said, no. He said, right, go home and pack a bag. He did everything. I don't really know how he did it. He was kind of wrapped me up in a blanket and just said, I'll sort this. Just ring your family or whoever you need to tell them to pack a bag. You're going. But it was a really good GP that cared, that did that. I was really lucky. Also, At that time, I don't anymore, but at that time I was in quite a good job and I had health insurance. St. John of God's I thought was fantastic. The care that I had there was unbelievable. I felt so lucky every moment I was in there for getting the chance to do this. My doctor was amazing. He'd come from the Priory in the UK, really, forward-thinking kind of person. Didn't mollycoddle you, you'd have a bit of crack with him. He, you know, really treated me like an adult and an equal, you know, and adamant about getting me better, and it worked. They have so much to offer. I learned how to make jewellery, did watercolour painting, we did creative writing, and you'd be sitting there with like one of the men, Eamon, in his 80s, and you'd be writing, you know, a short story together. Like, it was absolutely incredible. The staff were fantastic. Like, you've a whole team, you've a social worker as well, like, assigned to you. You'd have a bit of time to go to one of the classes, like, there'd be classes that you could pick, you know. One night we all watched on St. Paul's Ward, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest together. That was like hilarious. There was lots of fun. People in absolute dire straits making each other laugh. But it makes you realise how lucky you are. And it was an eye-opener into what is on offer, what could be on offer, but isn't there for everyone. And you watch people leave every day that were better now and they were going home. My journey has been really bloody hard and scary, but I am lucky and in a privileged position because of health insurance. Always working, that I was able to pay to see people privately. If I relapse again, I can pay. So what do you do if you don't have that? Where do you go? How long are you expected to wait for? Don't make the therapy and the stuff that I got for the fortunate few.
Nikki's experience was positive and absolutely doable with the right investment, the right plan, and crucially, the right thinking about mental health and well-being. We spoke to three people who have ideas, some might be considered quite radical ideas, about how we can truly put people at the centre if we challenge the culture underpinning our mental health services.
Well, I've been called a nincompoop, I've been called dangerous, I've been called an idiot, I've had complaints. There seem to be a vociferous minority of people who find these ideas, and they're certainly not only my ideas, they're the ideas of people possibly with a more sceptical, critical, scientific, evidence-based approach to mental health. There is a lot of kickback.
Peter Kinderman is a professor of psychology in the University of Liverpool and the author of a book, A Prescription for Psychiatry: Why We Need a Whole New Approach to Mental Health and Wellbeing. And he's pretty used to being challenged on his views.
A few people find the ideas really quite challenging. Maybe it challenges their set views of themselves or of their profession, maybe even of their income. The majority of people, I think, find it a refreshing point of view. I guess the criticism I would take most heed of is the idea that what we're talking about is lovely in a sort of kaftan wearing, Guardian reading, Lapsang Souchong sipping world of do-gooders, but how on earth are we going to actually make it reality?
My commitment is to truth. It's not to a biomedical model and it's not to a psychosocial model. My commitment is to truth.
Dr. Terry Lynch is a psychotherapist and GP living and working in Limerick, who wrote a number of books, including the bestseller Beyond Prozac. And he's been vociferous in his criticism of the current thinking in mental health.
I was working as a GP for 10 years, and I realised my training was not fit for purpose. I was doing people a disservice by being a GP in terms of mental health. It's the emotionality in psychology, the deep, deep understanding of people's inner worlds. That is the key. And that needs to be a prerequisite of the skills of the people who are the first line, but also obviously up the line.
My name is Pat Bracken. I'm a consultant psychiatrist. I'm from Cork. I became very disillusioned early on with psychiatry and the contradiction of my role in psychiatry as a doctor, caring for people, but also being tasked to control people and to have power over people. And I found that very, very difficult as a young doctor.
Pat is one of the founding members of an organisation called the Critical Psychiatry Network. They were established to question and sometimes challenge the assumptions psychiatry makes about what's important in mental health treatment models, as well as examining the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on the profession.
Critical thinking is a positive thing. Mm-hmm. It's not just a knocking. It's actually very, very important when you have power, when any group of people have power over other people, as we do in psychiatry. You have to be able to reflect critically on the history of your discipline, on the assumptions and practices, and to be able to see through them and to be able to see the limitations of them.
And crucially, Pat believes we need to radically reassess how we understand mental health and mental distress.
What we need to do is to have a really open discussion about how messy the world of mental health really is. All of our discussions are about getting rid of the messiness. We want to make it simple and straightforward. We want people to fit into little boxes, and therefore we can come up with treatment algorithms, just as we do in diabetic care or cancer care or something else like that. Mental health is different. Sometimes I think we don't really appreciate how different it is from the world of clinical medicine.
Dr. Terry Lynch told me about what he believes is a glaring missing component in our mental health care, recognising trauma and its impact on a person's mental health.
Trauma is a key aspect of every one of the psychiatric diagnoses. We have this notion that trauma only occurs in response to very big things, like major incidents in our life, whereas we humans are far more fragile than that, and we get hurt and wounded far more easily than that. In the vast majority, and perhaps in every single one, but certainly the vast majority of people I've worked with who have received a diagnosis of depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, OCD, there is a story of trauma that has been missed. In 2017, I gave an educational talk to GPs in Kilkenny. And there were over 100 GPs at that meeting. And I asked them, which of these two terms are you more comfortable with and more familiar with? Trauma or depression? 100% said depression. GPs have very little training in trauma, whereas depression has been emphasized to GPs for 30 years. So they're very comfortable with the concept of depression. So they see depression because it is what they are trained to look for. And they miss trauma, as do psychiatrists. In my experience, left, right and centre.
Back to Professor Peter Kinderman.
So I think there's still a reliance on explaining mental health problems in terms of failures of the individual, whether that's psychological failures or biological failures. Too much focus on the individual, too much focus on what's wrong with this person rather than what's wrong with society. Too much focus on medical explanations. There must be something wrong with her brain. She must have been born that way. We need to think of mental health problems, those things that are normally called mental health problems, even the most serious and life-changing of them, more as social and psychological phenomena than as medical illnesses. And that means turning the thing around to 180 degrees. So commonly we say, you know, these things are illnesses that have a social and psychological aspect. And I think we need to turn that around. These are social and psychological phenomena that may have a medical aspect to them. I believe passionately that we can find reasons for the occurrence of those experiences, nearly always in the things that have happened to us in our lives and how we've learned to respond to them. And then we need to provide people with help, practical help to solve the problems. If you're depressed because you're in debt and you've lost your job, then you need money and you need a job. If you're anxious and depressed because your partner is assaulting you, then we need to get the police in and we need to deal with it as a criminal activity. If you're frightened and reluctant to go to school because the kids at school are bullying you, then we need to work with the teachers and the principal of the school to make sure that people aren't bullying. We're pumping, yeah, maybe that's an evocative way to put it, but we are prescribing vast quantities of powerful psychiatric drugs to both adults and children, and there's precious little evidence of them being stunningly effective.
So building on what Terry Lynch is saying, that trauma is so often missing, Peter Kinderman is saying that there's also often significant social factors missing from how we make mental health diagnoses. What's emerging as very much needed, it seems, is a full paradigm shift in how we understand, talk about and think about mental health.
What I would argue is that the current paradigm in mental health across most disciplines is based on what I would call a technological paradigm. The term paradigm is important because it shapes how problems show up for us, how we're going to analyze those problems and what the solutions are going to be. The paradigm is a kind of a whole model of how this world works with examples and ideas, etc., etc. What I'm suggesting is a revolution in terms of our paradigm. It's as big a revolution in mental health as it was for Copernicus to say all those centuries ago that actually the Earth isn't at the center of the solar system. The sun is at the center of the solar system. We're going around the sun, not the other way around. And that's the best example in science of a major paradigm shift. What I'm talking about in mental health is of that level of significance, because we've thought for hundreds of years that we can model our work in mental health on the rest of medicine, on that technicalized approach that mental health problems are technical problems, you know, that we see mental health problems as arising from faults in the brain or in the mind, some kind of cognitive failing to process material correctly, etc., etc. But that mental health problems show up as the result of some kind of faulty mechanism, and that the job of us as professionals is to come up with models of those faults and then to intervene with people in a technical way to fix the faults. It doesn't ignore the non-technological issues such as relationships, meanings, values, etc. It doesn't exclude them altogether, but they're very much seen as of secondary importance. If you look at my own discipline in psychiatry, if you pick up any of the journals of psychiatry, you'll see 90% of the content will be about looking at genetics, looking at neurochemistry, looking at various drug trials, interventions, etc., etc. Very much so, the technological stuff is the meat.
A paradigm shift is urgently required. But we have demonstrated in Irish society that we're able for paradigm shifts.
Back to Dr. Terry Lynch.
We've done it in so many different areas of life. And we can do it with this, if there's a will.
This idea that a lot of the way our systems are set up is more about the system itself than about the people is one that's come up again and again throughout this series. And Peter Kinderman echoes this idea that all too often the lens through which we see mental health is less about people's experiences and more about how we want to interpret them.
There's a very revealing sentence in the abstract of a relatively recent scientific paper about psychiatric diagnosis. But they were talking about the psychiatric diagnostic system, and they pointed out that by conventional means, in their argument, the diagnoses that they used on a regular basis lack validity. They don't match up to anything in the real world. You know, there's no clear dividing line between being depressed and not being depressed, or being anxious and not being anxious. And they're unreliable. So one psychiatrist or one psychologist might identify post-traumatic stress disorder. The other psychiatrist or the other psychologist would suggest that the person is depressed. And a third one would say that they're anxious. And a fourth one would say that they've supposedly got a supposed personality disorder. So these two authors conclude that the psychiatric diagnoses aren't really very valid. They don't predict whether or not somebody will respond to any particular form of treatment, whether that's drugs or psychotherapy. But the psychiatric diagnosis remains an invaluable concept for the clinician. And I think that's very telling. I think that the reason why people hang on to these things is because it's useful for professionals. It's useful for the healthcare system. It's useful maybe for the civil servants running ministries of health. It's useful for the statisticians who count. What do they count? Well, at the moment, they count the number of kids who are off school or require help for ADHD. What they should be counting is the number of kids who get bullied at school, the number of children who are failing to thrive in the industrialized education system that we've got. So my point is that these things persist because they're useful. My point would be that they're not so useful for us as citizens, but they're quite useful for the entrenched powers that benefit from the system as we've got it. And that means professionals and pharmaceutical companies.
When it comes to mental health, the real meat, the real important stuff is the non-technological aspects.
Pat Bracken again.
Meanings and finding a path towards making meaning are actually at the heart of good mental health work. And values like dignity and respect are not secondary issues. These are the really important things. The science of antidepressant drug trials, for example, they show us if you take all the studies that have been done on antidepressants, yes, antidepressants work. About 2/3 of people who take them report a benefit. But what's clear from the drug trials is that those people who take the placebo in the controlled trials also get better. Most of them get better. Most of the effect of antidepressants can be explained by what we call the placebo effect. What is the placebo effect? That has to do with someone finding meaning. It's about a relationship between the person who is coming for help and the practitioner who is engaged with them, and together forming some kind of positive way out of the problem. The same is the case when you look at studies of psychotherapy. Again, psychotherapy works. Again, about 2/3 of people who go for psychotherapy at the end of it will say, I benefited from that, it was helpful. But what comes out very clearly from 30 years of psychotherapy research is that it doesn't appear to matter too much what set of techniques the therapist is trained in, whether they're a cognitive behaviorist therapist, humanist therapist, and this is borne out by study after study, is whether a relationship is formed between the therapist and the patient, whether the person coming for help feels listened to and heard and respected, and whether together they can come together to form meaning around where the distress is coming from and finding a path into the future.
A lot of systems have a way of shoring themselves up, protecting themselves. And these kinds of ideas and thinking would require such a fundamental change that it's hard to imagine taking hold. Peter Kinderman told me about how threatening this kind of deep change is to the system as it stands.
There's a responsibility on government and society to change, to protect children rather than medicate them, to put it bluntly. I think that's threatening to people who've got a vested interest either in not doing very much work and letting the system just improve, or passing the buck to the psychiatrists. Yeah. If there is a mass shooting in America, because there probably won't be a mass shooting in other parts of the world, then it's really convenient for everybody to say, you know, why wasn't the crazy person spotted? But to say, do we have to have a fundamental rethink of the principles on which our society is built, that's more difficult. If we need to invest more heavily in education, if we need to stop testing kids so much, if we need smaller class sizes, more individual attention, that's all expensive and people don't want to do it. And the professionals who are making jobs, like me, from supposedly treating supposed illnesses, don't like the idea of that source of income being cut and our profession being damaged.
But very often the people who work in mental health systems, their social position, as I say, the ticket to actually getting a salary is based on the technical.
Dr. Pat Bracken explains how vested interests can permeate the system, making it even more change resistant.
So yes, we as professionals hold on to it. And we say, I'm trained as this therapist or that therapist or a doctor or whatever. But secondly, when it comes to psychiatry, in the background of a great deal of psychiatric academic work in the last 20, 30 years has been the power of the pharmaceutical industry. They've made billions, literally billions, out of selling the idea that mental health problems can be all formulated in a diagnostic manual, that your depression or your anxiety can be easily listed a list of symptoms, and out of that comes a diagnosis, and with that diagnosis comes a drug treatment of one sort or another. And that simplistic idea of what mental health problems are about and how they're managed has become dominant. Mm. And it has become dominant for a reason, because it's actually made a fortune for the people who sell the drugs that go with that. And until we get real about that, you know, psychiatry is going to remain in that embrace.
I asked Terry, Peter and Pat to explain to me what practical steps we could try and take to adopt some of their ideas and build it into our existing systems.
What would a mental health facility look like from the start?
Dr. Pat Bracken.
We wouldn't have the first guy you meet as the security officer. We'd say, actually, the first thing you need to be is embraced and your dignity respected, even though you might be all over the place. And you might be trying to kill yourself or something, that our system, because we put values center and we take them seriously, we will really work to treat you with dignity and respect from the moment you get in touch with us. And that's not going to be a secondary issue. If relationships are really central, well, maybe you turning up at a clinic and seeing a different doctor every time you do, and telling your story to a different doctor. So you've got to start a new relationship every time you come to an outpatient clinic, which is what patients complain about all the time. Well, if we took relationships with professionals as important, we wouldn't run a system like that. We would see that as a major problem. Whereas now, it's not, because we model our mental health system on the back of, you going with an endocrine problem? Are you going with an orthopedic problem? Are you going with some other kind of physical health problem? That really the relationships in that arena are not seen as the most important. The real thing that's seen as important is the medical skills of the person who's responding to you on that particular day. I think we've got to stand back from the idea that the primary thing here is to put a label on it. Do you know what I mean? And that somehow think we've done something great. We've put a label on it. We made a diagnosis. I think we have to step back from that and start working more with, where is this coming from in this person's life? And people need different pathways to move on from being stuck. You know, there are very many different pathways out of being stuck. Sometimes it involves medication. Sometimes it can be therapy. But very often it has nothing to do with either of them. It can be about a new relationship. It can be about travel. It can be about creativity, poetry. It can be religion or spirituality. It can be about walking and exercise. There's multiple different things that work for people to move on from being stuck.
Peter Kinderman has a PhD student working with him, and they're currently researching a new way of recording what someone says to a clinician when they present with a mental health issue. And he talks about what a mental health system that took his thinking on board might look like with this shift in thinking.
And one of the things that we think is the potential for both radical but evolutionary change is to ask the question, what is it that we record on people's medical notes? So at the moment, copying the ideas of ordinary physical health medicine, what we put down on notes are diagnoses of illnesses. So you have major depressive disorder or social anxiety disorder or post-traumatic stress disorder. And they're little numerical codes that you enter into the computer system. And in research, the codes stand for these conditions that we, not me, but my colleagues, assume exist that you then study. So, you know, there is a code for post-traumatic stress disorder, and then you study the thing called post-traumatic stress disorder and you put the code down for it. One of the things that I'm arguing is that instead of thinking about the concept of post-traumatic stress disorder, we think about the concept of post-traumatic stress. So we're talking about a phenomenon and an experience and not an illness. That leads then on to, surely we should be studying combat or rape or road traffic accidents. So people develop, in the medicalized language, the disorder, which I'm skeptical of post-traumatic stress disorder, when their distress meets certain criteria following, for instance, being sexually assaulted. Both of the two major diagnostic manuals that we have in the world, the International Classification of Diseases that comes out of the World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, they allow you, of course, to record post-traumatic stress disorder. What they also allow, but almost nobody uses it, is to simply code for the sexual assault. So these manuals also include within them, sort of hidden in plain sight, these codes to record poverty, that's a code, homelessness, bullying and harassment, unemployment. It's not a terribly long list because the people drawing up these diagnostic manuals have focused on diseases. Part of my evolutionary model would be, instead of diagnosing somebody with post-traumatic stress disorder, what we should be doing is recording the fact that they've been assaulted. So Kate and I are recommending that what we do is to shift this dialogue towards the model that we want, is to not give up on the whole system, not throw it all away and just sit in a teepee and smoke illicit chemicals and stare longingly into space, but actually we use scientific and actuarial methods to support this sort of a model. So what we do is we record it if somebody's been bullied at school, and then we deal with the psychological consequences.
Pat Bracken talks about the Scandinavian treatment model, Open Dialogue, which he adopted in his practice in West Cork.
And it really puts an emphasis on when someone comes to the service, the first thing that happens is a little treatment group comes together to meet with that person and their family. So you get two or three people who are then going to work with that person over time, that there's going to be some continuity of the relationship with those people. The second thing with open dialogue is that it holds back, as I've talked about already, the diagnostic perspective, the medical perspective, or even the psychotherapeutic perspective, and tries to draw out on the basis of dialogue. They don't put a name on the problem. They come together with the person to name where the issues are. And if that person needs to see a specialist, social worker, therapist, psychologist, doctor, those people come into the treatment group. The key is the relationship and the openness that is created there.
I asked Peter Kinderman to paint a picture for me about what his ideal system would look like.
I would want close integration between social services and medical services, because let's say that in this pathway you pitched up at my door and I started talking to you about basically psychological therapy techniques. And you know, as we explored the reasons for your depression, you pointed out that you were struggling financially and that your housing was both inadequate and insecure. Well, I wouldn't want, as a psychotherapist, to say, right, well, that's a psychological issue that we are going to talk about, but you're going to have to solve. I'd want immediately to swivel around in my chair, pick up the phone, call one of my colleagues two doors down and say, let's do this jointly. You know, can you help sorting out the housing issue? And I'll continue to offer psychotherapy. And I'd want it to be much more integrated rather than in silos. I'd want us to think about your depression as a natural and understandable and empathizable with consequence of the situation that you find yourself in, or the things that happened to you in your childhood. I'd record in that instance that you had insecure housing. I think the system should know, and that you're experiencing depression. But I wouldn't diagnose you with an illness, and I wouldn't even assume that you had an illness. I'd hope to address the underlying problems. You know, if your kids are in trouble, we'll try to help you with that. If there are problems with housing, we'll try to help you with that. Maybe you're just responding as an ordinary human being to the fact that there's some crap in your life. If you needed to go into a residential place, I'd want it to be like a 4-star hotel. I don't want it to be like a ward of a hospital. I'd go, look, I'm really not happy with you going home tonight. You seem really distressed. You've talked about taking your own life. To be honest, you're very confused in the way that you're speaking to me. I'm really not happy with you going home tonight. I can arrange for a place in, you know, a residential unit for people with experiences just like yours. But I wouldn't want it to look like a hospital. I'd want it to look like a well-staffed hotel. Why? People aren't ill. People do need safety and security and respite. They don't need vacuum flasks and a charge nurse in a blue uniform with a clipboard checking on you. No, you need to be somewhere safe and secure. You're treated like an honoured guest rather than an ill patient. And then I wouldn't diagnose you with schizophrenia. I'd record the fact that you are hearing voices and have some scary paranoid fears. And I try to record the things that have happened to you in your life that might have contributed to that.
I asked Pat, Peter and Terry to tell me about what bothered them or worried them most about our current situation.
A significant part of the problem that is happening every day in our country, in possibly hundreds of doctor surgeries every day in this country, is the misinterpretation of people's experiences. So a person may go and say, I'm feeling down, I'm feeling depressed. And often within 5 or 10 minutes, the doctor transmutes these experiences into a medical diagnosis. Such a fundamental mistake. As long as that major error is continuing, there is no way that the mental health services as currently constructed can solve the mental health crisis we have. Doctors, GPs, from what I know, and I've been a doctor for over 30 years, receive little or no training in emotionality, psychology. A very good example of that, and a very serious and important one, is around suicidal thoughts. What tends to happen is that if a person says, I feel suicidal, or I'm having suicidal thoughts, once that is said, most doctors, they remain compassionate, yes, but they now see this as a risk. So quite quickly, often within a matter of minutes, the conversation changes to hospital admission, for example, or referral to psychiatrist. The problem with that is that the person is silenced and the person learns that there isn't room within the services for them to talk about their pain.
It annoys me that routinely children are exposed to homophobic bullying and yet they're the ones diagnosed with childhood depression. It annoys me that it takes, you know, the best advice that we've got is that you should probably try to reduce your antidepressants by about 10% per month, give or take. There are lots of different sort of rules, which means on average, it would take people about a year to come off antidepressant medication. And yet if I were to go to my GP tomorrow and say that I'm struggling at work and needed some time off, he would probably suggest to me that I go on antidepressants. And then if you think about the consequence of that, they'll then take me a year to come off them. And so all of those things annoy me. And therefore, should we just accept this? Yeah. Should we just accept the fact that the law of the land says, in black letter law, you may well have the autonomy to make decisions for yourself, but we're going to override it if we think you've got a mental illness. Should we tolerate that? I don't think we should.
My worry is that we start calling from, it becomes simply a conversation about resources. And too much of our media discussions about mental health at the moment, it simply boils down to more resources. Whenever there's a challenge to my own profession in psychiatry, they say, oh yeah, we'd be doing everything fine. We just need more staff. We need more teams. We need more. It's not that we need to radically engage with the assumptions that we're using, that we're building our systems and our, you know, from that point of view, we're still back in many ways in the institutions that we've physically got out of. A lot of our thinking about mental health is still coming from that history. So for me, the job now is about our thinking. And that's why I talk about the paradigm stuff. And hang on a second. Actually, most mental health problems are a messy mix of relationships that have gone terribly wrong, people not finding meaning or getting meanings all squashed up in odd ways, and of deep problems with self-respect and other people's respect, etc. Then we'll start to think, what could mental health services look like that took that seriously? And the primary thing about that is that that shifts us from the professionals have all the knowledge and expertise and authority. Well, if you take what I'm saying seriously, we don't. And actually, patients and their families are equal sources of expertise about this messy world of mental illness and mental health and how people get better. I meet loads of people who've had mental health breakdowns who never went into psychiatry and who tell me about how they got better. They had serious breakdowns at some stage in their lives, but they didn't. They were frightened of the system and didn't go into it. And they found ways of dealing with it, all sorts of ways. We've done some remarkable things in the world of mental health in the last, in my generation. We've moved out of those great big institutions, those asylums. A decision was made. It was a professional decision. It was a political decision. It was a community decision. All of those resources were mustered to say, we have to get away from this. And we've done it.
Pat is looking to the future, though, and remains positive and hopeful about the possibility of real change. We talked about what's needed to rebuild our mental health system around values, relationships, society, and people.
To me, it's an educational project. It's a developmental project. It's a political project. It's about shaping a different common sense about mental health. Just as, and we've done this in Ireland, we've shaped a different common sense around homosexuality in my generation. Well, I think we're going to have to start again, if you take what I say seriously, that I know you accept, come along the journey with me a little bit. We can't start measuring outcomes with the same tools that we measure outcomes from cancer services or from cardiology services. That's not going to work. If the issues are about relationships, about meanings, about values, then that's where we got to start. And for me, first thing we've got to do is create a service that people start to report once they've been in contact with that. I was treated with a sense of respect from the receptionist who answered the phone to me, to the consultant I met, to the nurse who visited me at home, or whatever it is. And if we could start by thinking 90% of all the people who go through our system will report that, I'd be happy that we're moving in the right direction. If people could start to say, well, actually, I saw the same people and the relationship was stable with them in the system. So there are ways that we can start to assess how we're doing, but you can't do it with the same kind of, you know, the idea that what we're doing is fixing a technical fault, and therefore, you know, if people are lower scores on a depression inventory or something after 3 weeks of treatment, we've done something wonderful. I think it's just, that's too simplistic for this messy, complex world. We need to be imaginative in how we are judging, are we going forward or not? You know, it's legal, it's cultural, it's the systems, but behind all of those, to me, it's about really engaging with our common sense, our understanding of where mental health problems come from.
One of the first changes needs to be the language. We need to change how we speak about emotional and mental health issues and problems. We need to start using terms like trauma, hurt. They need to become core aspects of the mental health services. I believe that such a mental health service would be accepted far more by people, would be far less frightening for them, far less stigmatizing. We talk a great deal in society about stigma. We fail to see the primary stigma. The primary stigma is not mental illness. The primary stigma is emotions and distress.
I wonder how these guys and all the other people who are seeking to create this kind of revolutionary change, I wonder how they feel being at the coalface with this bleeding edge kind of thinking. Sometimes I found myself agreeing with them wholeheartedly, thinking this is something really deeply profound. And at other times, I felt myself bristling. We make assessments all day long based on our paradigms, our ways of understanding the world. The prism through which we look at things is often invisible to us. And there's a certain freedom that comes with playing with these ideas. Sometimes, even if we don't jump one way or another, it's useful and interesting and weirdly liberating to think big.
I hold great hope, but I'm a realist as well. So I can see the vested interests and how they stymie progress. But Ireland is a pretty progressive country, as we've seen over the years. The Ireland of 2018 has changed so much from the Ireland even 10 years ago. Gay marriage, the abortion referendum, so many major changes. And if we can address societal issues such as that, then we can address mental health.
The most important ingredient is hope. And it is our job to create hope, to work with hope, both on an individual basis, but also on a wider social basis. we are in an exciting time. I think in Ireland, we're at a very exciting time in terms of our culture, in terms of our identity, in terms of what we've done, what we've achieved in the last number of years. We've done some great things and we have to be proud of it. I think in mental health, we have the ability to radically and for revolutionary change in how we understand mental health problems, just as we've shifted in terms of gay rights, in terms of women's position, etc., etc., in terms of the church and the dominance of the church. I grew up in Ireland in the 60s and 70s, and the way the world was presented to us, the common sense about the world that was presented to us, we've overthrown that. We've changed. We've got them off our backs. You know, in a very short period of time. And that's been a magnificent combination of activism, law change, you know, campaigning, all sorts of levels. We've worked to do that. And at the moment in Ireland, we've started, you know, in the last 10 years to really, the mental health field, you know, has really started to open up.
Ultimately, though, when all is said and done, understanding people's own experiences of mental health is key to understanding what good looks like. There are vested interests in all major battlegrounds. But we believe that what we're doing now isn't working. The goal, everyone's goal, is and should be that people are well, live better lives, where emotional distress is lessened and manageable. And in order to change, we need to hear what different might look like. There are biological components to mental health, and we know that many people thrive really well on psychiatric medication and with the help of the committed professionals working in our current system. But it is very hard to continue to defend putting that biological model solely at the centre, sometimes to the detriment of the economic, social and political factors, which can be missed in a busy A&E or in a crowded and fluey doctor's surgery. Having spent the last number of months researching our mental health system, asking what good might look like, trying to find out how we can create change, it's clear to me that we absolutely can succeed in building a system that is so much better. But what's not at all clear to me is if we will succeed. But where there's a will, there's a way. And our job now is to pave that way together. This has been the final episode of our six-part series, but we're back next week with a bonus live episode as part of the wonderful first fortnight Mental Health and Arts Festival. We'd love if you would come and hang out with us for the night at the first fortnight event. It's on the 17th of January at 7 p.m. in the Wood Quay venue. You can register your place for free on www.firstfortnight.ie and search for Where There's a Will. We'll have live music and you'll hear from some of the contributors to this podcast about what needs to happen next. You can ask questions and share your views. And if you can't make it, you'll hear that live episode at the end of January in this feed. So stay subscribed. Thanks so much for listening and for staying on this journey with us. Happy New Year and take care.
And just as a reminder, if you have been affected by any of the issues raised by this podcast, there is help available. If you or someone you know needs immediate help or is in crisis, phone the free Pieta House 24-hour suicide helpline on 1800 247 247 or text HELP to 51444. If you just need to talk, you can also contact the Samaritans, Aware or your local GP. Check out alustforlife.com for contact information for all of the support available.
Where there's a will, the podcast series From a Lust for Life is brought to you by Revive Active, Ireland's all-natural super supplements, formulated by scientists and delivering real benefits.